This episode of The Urbanist was first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. In this episode, how the hell did that get built?
Everywhere in the GDR you would find these huge slabs of housing, also depending on when they were built, but also ugly.
City building at its best is innovative, democratic and aesthetically on point. But that's sadly not always the case. This week's episode takes a look at cathedrals of corruption, building blunders and the plain just ugly. How do these things see the light of day? Over the next hour, we'll head to Zaragoza, Jerusalem and Rio de Janeiro, visiting some of the more infamous architectural additions to those cities. And we'll also ask, does a city even need a planner in the first place? Stay tuned. And to kick off this rather ugly edition of The Urbanist, let's head to Brazil. In Rio de Janeiro, as you drive out to the future Olympic Village in the west zone of Barra, you can't help but notice Cidade das Artes, the fantastical concrete structure designed by French architect Christian de Ponsanpark, is South America's largest modern concert hall with a seating capacity of nearly 1,800 people. And at a size of 90,000 square metres, it's hard to miss. But the structure hasn't come without controversy. Cidade das Artes took years longer than expected to open, and at a price tag that was around six times the originally proposed budget, which leaves the question if it was even worth building in the first place. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, visited Cidade das Artes to see what the musical shrine means to cariocas.
Stepping inside Cidade das Artes, you can't help but be impressed. The fantastical structure is both impressive in size and design, mixing the look and feel of the Brazilian modernist movement with a touch of European influence. With 12 practice rooms and several concert halls, the modernist structure is a dream come true for any musician or lover of classical music. But Cidade das Artes, which was originally known as Cidade da Música, wasn't built without controversy. Aside from the fact that the project took over a decade to build, the final bill came in an estimated six times higher than what was originally budgeted for. And it was all built with public money.
When the new mayor assumed this building, this Cidade da Música, in the first place, he changed the name for Cidade das Artes.
André Nadeo is a journalist for Terra, an online news portal in Brazil. He wrote about Cidade das Artes and explains why it attracted so much public attention.
Cidade da Música, in the first place, was an idea of the former mayor of Rio de Janeiro. His name is Cesar Maia. In the first place, it was designed for in November 2002. So originally, this supposed to cost to the, public money, let's not forget about that, 8 million reais, what in pounds would be like around 18 million pounds. So at that time, didn't count that many attention. It was cool. People were like, fine. In Barra da Tijuca, it would be nice, a nice place for people like going to the theater, have some concerts. Well, one more option of entertainment here in Rio de Janeiro. But the thing is, with the passing of the years, this money has been increased a lot. So, in 10 years, from 2002, from 2012, Rio de Janeiro has spent 500 million reais, which costs, around 75 million pounds, So, of course, called the attention of the population, and a lot of people were criticizing about this. Because, do we need this? We are running out of, for example, money from education, from public transportation. Because of this fact, about this huge amount of public money, the news, all the people are starting to look more at this.
And after some investigative journalism on his part, André spoke with some people who took part in making this cost structure skyrocket from 86 million reais to nearly 600 million reais. Without naming any names, André Nandeo explains how Cidade das Artes' cost grew over a 10-year construction period.
The bill is supposed to cost, like, properly 10,000 reais. He should sign it for 30,000 reais. And, of course, that's 20,000 more than it's supposed to cost. So they split it up. I mean, they are going to divide between those guys who were supposed to have this money for themselves. He told me that happened 3 times. And, of course, I mean, the authorities, this amount, this huge amount, called the attention of the authorities. So they started an investigation for themselves, and they discovered a lot of stuff that had a huge amount of money, like people paying twice for the same stuff.
Now, with stories like that, it's no wonder that the average carioca tends to regard the building as a giant, glaring symbol of corruption in Rio de Janeiro. Carlos Eduardo dos Santos is a Rio de Janeiro taxi driver, and he drives by Cidade das Artes nearly every day.
O prédio em si é prédio bonito, o espaço é bom.
He admits that he's never been inside Cidade das Artes, but the building itself, he says, is nice. It's a good space. He says that it was built during the César Maia administration and then just left as an empty building. It has a nickname of being a white elephant, he says. He says that for many people in Rio de Janeiro's working class, like himself, the building wasn't worth it to be built at a high price that it cost.
Não sei te dizer que eu nunca fui lá, mas o espaço lá é bom.
He says that even though he doesn't go to concerts at Cidade das Artes, he thinks it's important to have cultural centers like this in Rio. He thinks that it's a positive thing that the current mayor, Eduardo Paes, took an initiative to host more events at Cidade das Artes. There is a positive side, though, to Cidade das Artes. It's now become home for around 100 of Brazil's classical musicians. Thirty-year-old Rafael Paixão is one of them. He plays a trombone in the Brazilian Symphony Orchestra. In fact, he's the lead trombone in the orchestra, which now calls Cidade das Artes home since March of last year. Before then, the OSB was homeless. As Rafael shows me around Cidade das Artes, he explains why the building, despite the controversy, is so important to him.
Yeah, for me it's very important because now the orchestra has a house, and for us it's very, very important to create our identity, our sound, and to improve our technique as a musician. As a person, it's very, very good to have a place to rehearse. It's very important to have a big house or a big place like this with many different halls, with electroacoustic hall, with a chamber music hall, with a big hall, and also a library. So it's a cultural space that everyone can use.
So the fallout of all this, after all said and done, cariocas are getting more culture and Cidade das Artes is starting to be used more often, just a short 13 years after the project was proposed. But what happened to the investigations into potential corruption over the inflated price of Cidade das Artes?
Nothing happened at all. I mean, they made those kind of investigation, but let's just forget about it. Because these people who make the fiscalization, of course, they send some like notes to the mayor, but just Eduardo Paes said, there's nothing to do about me. This is something I'm just dealing with now.
With inflated infrastructure costs starting to rear their ugly heads from World Cup infrastructure, and even more recently in the ongoing Lava Jato car wash scandal that has plagued Brazil's state-run oil company for the past year, Cidade das Artes just seems to be one of many cases in Brazil where building costs have soared purely to line the pockets of those in power. But at least we're left being able to listen to some beautiful music. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
It's not uncommon for people to live in neighbourhoods that are completely unplanned. In fact, slums and informal settlements are home to the majority of residents in Karachi and Nairobi, for example. These places are not necessarily benchmarks for urban development, but perhaps they can still teach us some key lessons. For this, we turn to Dr. Christian Werthmann, chair of the UN Habitat Hub for Informal Urbanisation.
Well, it's something that has been going on for a while in our urbanization, and our urbanization, if it is in Europe or somewhere else on the planet, is mainly coming into being as informal settlements. Planning is fairly a young discipline, but today we think like everything that is kind of peering outside of typical planning agencies and master plans of cities is called informal, but it's actually the mainstream of urbanization, or this, it's our history actually. And it's looking all over the planet fairly different. It depends on the age and on the location of cities where people basically take their fate in their own hands and build their own cities. So there is no face to informality that you can say the typical images that you have in magazines of favelas in Rio or in Caracas, the barrios of very poorly built housing in hills is just one face of it. I mean, there are informally built areas on the planet that are very, let's say, medium to high level neighborhoods. And of course, there's also the other extreme of very, very harsh condition that people live in, going down to having houses out of cardboards or have no house at all.
So this planning with no planning and design with no design that people are doing on their own, are there benefits to this? Are these the kind of popular image of these very negative places? Are people creating things in a way that is positive?
It's like with every neighborhood, there are good sides and bad sides. There have been times, and in the common media often, that the bad sides of so-called slums, I don't use that word anymore, but that's the common word, are depicted in terms of, you know, horrible sewage problems and trash and crime and badly built housing that is then easy prey to all kinds of natural catastrophes, etc. And then since the 50s, there has been also inside the professions who engage with that, like planners and designers, there has been a growing acknowledgement of all the virtues of self-built neighborhoods that mostly rely in their realm of, you observe often a better social cohesion, people know each other, it's not anonymous. In these self-built cities, they people rely on informal networks of getting employment, of watching your children, so they know each other. It doesn't have the anonymous aspect of many large cities, and there are help networks, informal ones, that create a certain social cohesion that are very positive and that most the newly planned neighborhoods don't achieve, because that's one of the biggest problems for planners. How do you build a well-functioning, socially well-functioning neighborhood? And there are not many examples on the planet where this worked. And when we go into these informal areas, we often find well-functioning social networks. But it's also depending on the neighborhood itself. I mean, there are also some that don't have that. Sometimes like refugee camps or neighborhoods that came up very fast through a crisis, and there is no social network yet. So there are virtues, especially on the social side. There's actually, like in Rio and Sao Paulo, we found more employment than people think, like that. They think people are unemployed in these areas. No, they often work 2-3 jobs. But it depends also on the economy and in which country you are.
As urban populations grow and we go on building cities in a formal way, with master plans, large-scale development, and city planners, the majority of the world will be built informally. As these urban areas exist outside of what many of us consider to be the norm, but are in fact growing in dominance, a global challenge will be to acknowledge the informal areas, to understand more about how they get built and why, and the ways in which we can help to improve our shared urban future. For Monocle in Hanover, I'm Jessica Bridger.
Coming up in the programme, we assess the legacy of Zaragoza's World Expo, talk about the role of architects and planners, have a look at Germany's Plattenbau, and check Holy Land Towers in Jerusalem. Stay with us.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulet or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Urbanist. I'm Andrew Tuck. In this episode, we ask, how did that get built? Hosting a World Expo can bring a city both fame and fortune, but also provides an opportunity to transform. When the lesser-known Spanish city of Zaragoza put its hat in the ring to bring the world to its doorstep in 2008, the city rallied behind a project promising new infrastructure, architectural icons, and a rejuvenated river. The theme was water and sustainable development. Not bad for a city perched on the edge of Europe's biggest desert. So, how did the city manage to unify so quickly? And 6 years since the expo finished, what legacy has been left in its wake? And Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous went on a trip to investigate.
I've just stepped outside Zaragoza's colossal Delicias train station, where before me a cluster of conspicuous modern buildings sprouts from the bed of the Ebro River. They strongly contrast with Zaragoza's historic character, which has evolved over millennia. These gleaming forms of glass and concrete, however, are barely a decade old. So how did they get here?
There will be a before and an after in the question of water and sustainable development, marked by Expo Zaragoza 2008.
Held in 2008, the Zaragoza World Expo has had a lasting impact on a city which, located somewhere between Madrid and Barcelona and bordering Europe's largest desert, had long been one of Spain's more obscure regional capitals. The quest for a resurgence, and indeed relevance, had been bubbling below the surface for a while, and hosting a World Expo was seen as a means rather than an end.
After the expo, Zaragoza is a different city.
I'm talking to Francisco Pellecer Corellano, a university professor and one of the technical directors of the World Expo project. We're inside the River Ebro Environmental Center, where a video exhibition is currently showing how immense the change was.
Everyone agreed that it had to be changed. Everyone knew it was going to be extremely expensive. Everyone knew it was impossible to achieve using just money generated from City Hall. So we asked ourselves, what have other cities around the world done to transform, and how did they obtain the necessary resources?
As Professor Pellecer goes on to tell me, consensus to renovate the city was reached by local planners and architects back in 1996. Despite being the lifeblood of Zaragoza, the city had turned its back on the increasingly polluted River Ebro. Something needed to be done. Political wrangling would see this dream gather dust for several more years, until the idea to use a World Expo as the vehicle for change inspired local and national politicians. The rush was now on to turn the grand project into a reality.
The first thing we studied were the ghosts of past expos. We all know that ghosts don't exist, but they're still scary. And this is especially true in the political arena and in the minds of people, where they can do just as much damage as real things. The ghost of the Seville Expo was the issue of reuse. The facilities were later abandoned, another was The Ghost of Hanover in 2000. The project was hugely expensive and generated a tremendous deficit. And then there was The Ghost of Lisbon from 1998, where the expo was only held in one part of the city and the rest was ignored.
Learning from their World Expo predecessors, strategies were drawn up to ensure the new infrastructure was targeted at the real needs of the city. The expo's events were placed around the urban centre to involve citizens, and the vast costs were spread around various departments in order to dissipate the budgetary impact. Years later, I asked the professor to rate the 2.3 billion euro project's success.
The expo's director asked me the same question, and I said, I am 120% satisfied. Even in the best case scenario, I would never have thought that the expo would turn out so nicely, produce such interesting results, and especially leave such a lasting and important mark on the city. But I added, you should understand that there are also some things that I didn't like, okay?
And with that glowing review, I head outside where I walk along the admittedly impressive new park straddling a much healthier Ebro River. However, to get a fresh perspective, I pay a visit to the esteemed studio of Bernabad Architects to talk to co-founder and urbanism expert Francisco de la Cruz.
In our opinion, the most important achievement of the general project is the way to perceive the city has changed completely, because after the expo, the river has been discovered by the population. That's, in our opinion, the most important achievement. Another of the achievements is that it has allowed both shores to be connected with many different bridges, pedestrian bridges and also bridges for cars with different speeds. So that's very, very important for the project.
A lot of positive things have been said about the benefits of rejuvenating the river, but there were also some big buildings built as well in the World Expo zone. Let's look at the map that I have laid out before us.
In my opinion, that's one of the failures of the expo is that it was said before the expo was going to happen that the projects they were going to be thought for the present and after the expo. But that has not been successful, because some of the iconic buildings like the Torre del Agua, the water tower, or the pedestrian bridge by Zaha Hadid, or the Pavilion of Spain or the Pavilion of Aragon, 6 years after the end of the expo, they are completely empty. And in a way you can understand that it's because of the crisis, but in another way, if the form of the building, if the shape of the building had been thought differently, the Torre del Agua is a ramp like the Guggenheim, but concentrated in a vertical building. It's about 20 stories high, and there was a cafeteria on the roof of the building at the top that was very interesting because of the views, and the entire building was a ramp around a hanging sculpture, a very beautiful sculpture hanging from the ceiling in the emptiness of the hole that was inside the building.
So the building was hollow to show off the symbol of the World Expo, which was water, and then I believe there were plans to build office space in there afterwards.
But you cannot, it's very hard to change, to convert that building into an office building, because the entire perimeter of the facade is the ramp that connects the different levels of the building. So it is almost impossible to convert that use to an office-use building.
Francisco also believes that mixed-use options are currently being overlooked. He suggests converting it into a combined residential, retail, or even university campus complex.
There is only life during the day. Once all of those buildings close, in the evening there is no one over there. If those new uses like residential or these other uses that happen all the time during the day and during the night, that would have changed completely the way to perceive the space. People are very critical mainly with these two buildings, with the Torre del Agua and the Bridge Pavilion by Zaha Hadid, because everyone knows that they cost cost more than 80 million euros, so people don't understand that those buildings were built and they are useless at this time. So that makes people be very angry about that. But at the same time, the legacy of the expo is very positive in the way that the main public space in the city now is the river.
With these two differing perspectives in mind, it is clear that the city greatly benefited from the expo. However, while great consideration was given to past expo failures, the rush to complete the metamorphosis on time meant that it wasn't possible to take every foreseeable problem into account. So, back to that cluster of modern, but apparently hollow buildings. Rather than see them as a reminder of money spent and wasted, perhaps new vision is required to fill them with something that could shape the next phase of this re-energized and now less obscure city's future. For Monocle in Zaragoza, I'm Liam Aldous.
The dynamics behind architecture and city building are, of course, not static. They react to demand or political desires. They're shaped by a changing relationship between the architect and the developer, and they're not always very fair. Earlier, Paul Finch, Programme Director of the World Architecture Festival, joined me and urbanist producer David Michon to discuss what it is that makes buildings happen.
As ever with cities, you have to look at a whole complex web of contributors and interactions between them, which then end up in buildings of all sorts of description and all sorts of types. So, for example, at the moment in London, not the only city, but probably the most prominent international city where international finance, partly looking for a safe haven, partly looking for apartments that the kids might occupy when they become students in London, if they're from Asian families, has triggered this wave of residential development, the like of which we haven't seen in London ever before, because it's being underwritten by overseas money. People who may never live in these buildings, but who like our legal regime, they like the stability, the political stability of the British system. So they think, well, actually, I'll invest my money in an apartment or a pair of apartments. They'll accumulate in terms of capital gain. I'm allowed to buy outright in the UK, which I can't do in other parts of the world. I'll either just hold them and watch the value go up, provided that London doesn't actually build enough housing for all its citizens. Or alternatively, I can rent it out. But either way, I'm not going to pay too much tax on this. It really is a safe haven. Now, by contrast, in the commercial world, there's a much more what you might call domestic market, a huge wall of finance from British commercial insurance companies and, of course, pension funds, in a sense, representing public money or quasi-public money, because all those pensions have been paid for by us and all those insurance policies have been taken out by us. But they too need a safe haven for some of their money in the form of commercial property, hence the continuing construction and development of significant office buildings, retail parks and so on and so forth. And so when you look round the city, you might well say, how can a place which produced or allowed that also have allowed that? And the answer is because it's different money and different people with different timescales, and of course sometimes different planning regimes going from borough to borough.
Has the relationship between architects and developers changed? And this, I guess, is just anecdotal, but from some of the architects I know who've even had parents who were architects, have kind of described a kind of loss of power of the architect, you know, in relationship to the needs and demands of the developer.
The construction industry has started to professionalize. So the construction industry likes to go and make an offer, ultimately through things like the private finance initiative, to clients, and they say, I will build this for X pounds and I'll take the risk of any cost overrun. And in effect, you're going to be paying me a principal for safety about the job coming in properly, and I'll employ the architect. So instead of the architect nominating the contractor and advising the client on who to build, you get this curious reversal where architects start working for contractors. Now, the problem with that is, who's to say if the contractor's really building what the architect designed? If the architect is working for the contractor and not for the client, who represents the client interest? And this is a dilemma which hasn't truly been resolved. The built outcome, as far as cities are concerned, I would say, has generally been not great, because the authority and status of the architect as a designer has to some extent been nibbled at by the contractor, whose story to the developer or the client, if they're a kind of non-specialist client, is that, you know, we're businessmen, we'll look after you, and the aesthetes, they just design things. Well, actually, they don't just design things, they design the processes as well as the actual bricks and mortar and the appearance. But there are a lot of economic forces, just as there were at the start of the 19th century, trying to attack the position of the architect as king of the castle, because they have their own financial vested interests to take more control.
That was Paul Finch, Programme Director of the World Architecture Festival. Still ahead in the programme, how did East Germany's Plattenbau ever get built? And we visit Jerusalem's Holy Land Towers. Stay with us.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to The Urbanist on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Divided Germany left behind many a legacy, and in the eastern German states, the Plattenbau, translation prefabricated socialist housing estate, is one of the most visible. What was the impetus to build so many unsightly grey housing blocks in the years after the war? And how were they built? Are all Plattenbauten the same? How have East German cities coped with vacancy, lack of maintenance, and just plain ugliness in these estates in the years since the wall fell? Well, our contributor, Kimberly Bradley, sat down with Berlin architecture journalist Florian Heilmeier, who explains the stories behind East Germany's ubiquitous slabs.
The term Plattenbau in German refers to what was built during the GDR as mass prefabricated social housing complexes. If you hear the term, you would always imagine something very big, very grey, very ugly, very industrial.
Where do you find them?
You find them everywhere in Eastern Germany, in every city and in every village, basically. You see, the Plattenbau program was a program by the state, basically as a redevelopment after the war, after the devastations of the war in Germany. There was a huge need for housing. And like in many other European countries, of course, after World War II, the GDR decided to start this program to build at an enormous scale and at an enormous pace a lot of modern housing complexes. Of course, the basic idea was to improve living conditions for everyone, to accommodate everyone in modern flats with a shower, with a bathtub, with a heating, mostly even with an elevator. That was a very idealistic idea at the start. But then when they had to find ways how to realize these idealistic ideas, they had, of course, to make certain compromises with budget, with building techniques, with building materials, because how do you manage to accomplish such an enormous program in so little time?
As socialism ended, what happened to the Plattenbau at first?
When socialism ended in 89, or at least the GDR ended in 89, the Plattenbauten by then were mostly referred to as bad living conditions, out of many reasons. Western Germany already had lots of funding programs for private housing, and these subsidies programs were all of a sudden available in Eastern Germany. So lots and lots and lots of people moved out of the Plattenbau again, buying a new, shiny, little house, mostly even in the direct surroundings of their former Plattenbau that caused a lot of like very surrealistic situations then in the 90s in Eastern Germany, because you would like face a huge socialist housing project that was half empty already, where all these owners of these social housing complexes tried to like get at least one or two of the buildings completely empty so they could tear it down. But half of the people were already gone voluntarily, leaving only the people behind that couldn't afford to move out of it.
This was happening throughout Eastern Germany, and you'd see sometimes reports of one older man left alone in a Plattenbau, and many, many were demolished. But there was this other movement where in Berlin, in the center, near Alexanderplatz, they became a bit trendy amongst a certain type of person, whereas those on the periphery, like Marzahn, or in other cities like Halle, they fell into ruin or were demolished, or they were refurbished or had some interim use. Could you talk about the more positive, less socially problematic uses of Plattenbau since 89?
Basically, it's very easy because every investor would agree that there is one thing that decides about the success of a housing scheme, and it's always, where is it? And of course, there are Plattenbauten where it didn't even was talked about or discussed if they would be demolished, because they were in so central places, in Berlin, in Leipzig, in Dresden, you everywhere in the GDR you would find these huge slabs of housing, also depending on when they were built, but also ugly. But in Berlin or in the central parts of other cities, they would never tear it down because it was still sought after. And here, of course, we touch something that became more and more important in the course of the last over the last years. There is a need for affordable housing in the city centers, and the Plattenbau offers that.
What do these Plattenbauten look like now? We talk a lot about how ugly they are, but even in my time in Berlin, I've noticed a lot of sometimes simply cosmetic improvements, like a couple of coats of paint, or other refurbishments that involve more architectural intervention.
In very general terms, after 1990, if you take a look at the Plattenbauten all over the GDR, everything has been done to Plattenbau. They demolished it completely. They took it apart. They tried to build new housings out of it, which I think was one of the most interesting experiments ever, because it basically refers to the basic logic of a Plattenbau. It's been built out of modules. Why not try to take them apart again and use them as modules for different types of housing, like a Tetris game or something like this, really like a Tetris game. But it proved too expensive, so they tried to make them look nicer with like new colors. They tried to make them cute, which was like one of the most terrible things they ever did to a Plattenbau, to make this like gray slab look cute, because they just don't look cute, and it's against their nature to look cute. They are giant slabs of housing, and they will be giant slabs of housing also if you color them in, like, I don't know, nice childish colors. You have to refer, if you want to deal with Plattenbauten, not tearing them down, making them nicer again, you have to really take a look at their basic logic, at the architectural structures behind it. And starting from there, you can do a lot. You can add balconies, you can remove certain parts of the giant building, you can add roof terraces, you can try to make maisonette apartments. So one thing that you would have to do with a Plattenbau to try to make it a contemporary form of living again is, of course, to make it possible in a Plattenbau to offer good apartments for different types of inhabitants.
Do you think that's the future of the Plattenbau?
There will be many futures for the Plattenbau. Of course, there will be still Plattenbauten being torn down, which is, again, mostly due to where they are. While other Plattenbauten will be reused, transformed, rebuilt. And of course, you don't use the term Plattenbau today anymore, but it is interesting to see how many current housing projects refer to the basic logic of the prefabricated way of building. We always need a lot of new housing because we have a constant need of new typologies, new buildings, maybe in new places where there are not enough apartments yet. So there is basically, again, a situation where we need to produce a large amount of apartments anew. It's just that no one refers to Plattenbau because it has such a bad image. And we'll see as the generations before us, I mean in the 50s or 60s, the generations of planners and architects that believed so much in the Plattenbau, that it would be a better way of living. And we can only see what the generations that come after us, what they will think of the buildings that we built.
That was Florian Heilmeier speaking to Kimberly Bradley in Berlin. It's time now for this week's Urbanist Commentary, and guess who's going to read it? As you know, today we are talking along the lines of how the hell did that get built? The starting point for this episode was spotting a giant new pug-ugly building in London that looks out of place, is all unnecessary flourishes and wavy lines, and is sure to go out of date faster than a bag of lettuce. London's planning rules can be ridiculously restrictive, and people trying to build a modern house in the city can face years of pushback from planning committees who seem fixed on making sure everything is vaguely the same. They will tell you what colour bricks you can use and how your windows should open. But then, suddenly, you see something like the pug-ugly building and you wonder, WTF? Did they really think this part of the city not good enough to look after? Did they make a failed bid at getting something unique and extraordinary built here? Who knows? But it leaves Londoners who've had the most innocuous planning requests rejected scratching their heads. Now, usually these columns come to a nice, swift conclusion, but I'm not sure how you make the planning world a perfect one. One solution would be to follow the heritage city route, where in particularly pretty or complete places, the planners make sure that anything that gets erected must be of a certain height or be painted in just two or three designated colours. And yes, you rock up in a Munich or Bath or Mykonos, and that uniformity is kind of comforting and impressive even. But there's no hope of ever seeing, say, a John Porson minimalist masterpiece next to a Georgian house. And you risk a diet of pastiche that is never going to be very satisfying. The other route is to have looser rules that allow a more eclectic-looking city to evolve. Look at Tokyo, where no two buildings ever seem to be cut from the same cloth. And yet in Tokyo, where the building quality is high, the results are exciting and intriguing. Sure, you get some wackiness and some ugliness too, but on the whole, the chaos unites into something kind of cohesive. So, what's better? Now, you're going to say something in the boring middle, but that's what London has now, and it leaves you with a painful skyline of monstrosities, given the nod by planners who have no passion for aesthetics. But even if you put architects, urbanists, or artists in charge, would you really be guaranteed great buildings? Planning for a big metropolis is an imperfect science, and until we come up with a fresh solution, the odd pile of hideousness will have to be tolerated. And just before we head off, let's make a quick stop in Jerusalem. The stone-walled old city goes back more than 2,000 years, and it's the inspiration for the low, modest apartment buildings that cover the hillsides outside the ancient centre. There's even a law on the books that requires every building in Jerusalem to be faced in limestone, which lends the city a rosy glow when the sunlight hits the stones in late afternoon. So just imagine the shock to locals when a blocky set of 12 towers, including one that stretched up 18 floors, began taking shape on a prominent hillside in the south of the city. Called Holy Land, the project was so incongruous that locals swore it must be the product of corruption. And they were right. Last year, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was sentenced to 6 years in jail for accepting bribes to allow Holy Land zoning variances when he was mayor of Jerusalem in 1996. Daniela Czeslow visited Holy Land Towers and brings us this report.
My sister-in-law said to me, "Are you crazy? It's like a wound in the environment." So I told her, "The only place in the city where you don't see this wound, it's here when you're living it."
Accountant Danny Sarnat and his wife, Devorah, were among the first people to buy an apartment in the Holy Land residential complex 13 years ago. At the time, they were looking for a nice place to raise their two sons, a little removed from the city. Also, as early buyers, they got a great deal on a sprawling duplex on the 8th floor. At first, it seemed like a normal luxury compound, even if it is a bit blocky. They live inside a chain of 5 8-story towers, connected at the tops by other apartments built as bridges in the air. The Sarnat's penthouse is filled with fresh sunlight, and there are loads of balconies.
One, two, Up there are two more. Four and the roof garden. Oh, this is a different angle of the view.
There are fantastic vistas of all of Jerusalem, down to the gentle hills of Bethlehem. There's a jacuzzi on the rooftop.
This is a spa. Oh yeah, it's still working. Yeah.
And there are large steel sculptures on the walls, custom made by an Israeli artist. For 9 years, the Sarnats enjoyed the remote, spacious apartment, until police began investigating in 2010 just how Holy Land rose to 12 times the height allowed in its original building permits.
For the first few weeks, there was like each day about 40 or 50 buses of tourists coming here. It was like part of this city tour of Jerusalem, and they were all looking at us like we felt like in a zoo, like, you know, people staring at us all the time.
This gawking was especially unpleasant because the Sarnat's master bathroom has floor-to-ceiling windows, even if it is up on the eighth floor. But as awkward as the public scandal was, it was also validating. Danny and Devorah had suspected something fishy for a while. For one thing, Holy Land is named after a hotel that used to stand on this ridge. The initial plans for the housing complex included rebuilding the hotel.
When I bought this place, I was thinking I'm going to use the swimming pool from the right next door hotel, but then they canceled the hotel to build more apartments.
Then the size and shape of the buildings changed. Holy Land was planned as two chains of five interconnected towers, flanked by two taller buildings. Only one of those taller towers got built. It's right next to the tower where Sarnat lives. It's square and chunky, with large balconies jutting off the sides.
This big monster tower that you see right next to us wasn't planned as is. It was planned like a thin, like a needle tower, and they had it in the brochure. And then they changed this needle tower to a huge monster, which is really terrible. And we didn't know, of course, about that.
So today, the sweeping views out of Sarnat's apartment only go in three directions because the blocky tower obstructs his view of the Israeli parliament and the Israel Museum. Sarnat and some of the other building residents protested these changes at City Hall.
And then when I was sitting there with the committee, I saw that they are not paying attention. We gave them a lot of good arguments with experts that their change of plans of the Holy Land should be not approved. And they didn't listen to us, and they didn't even want to hear us. I mean, they heard us because they have to by law, but what we said had no impression on them. So that's when I knew that something was wrong.
Sarnat was right. Police began investigating allegations of bribery in 2010. Their case centered on businessman Shmuel Dechner, who turned state's witness and admitted delivering millions of shekels to decision-makers back in the 1990s, when Ehud Olmert was mayor of Jerusalem. That money went to Olmert's secretary, his lawyer, and his brother, Yossi.
Convicted of corruption, an Israeli court decided that former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert accepted bribes.
In early 2014, Olmert was convicted along with nine other defendants for accepting the bribes. Well before a Tel Aviv judge made his decision, ordinary Israelis denounced the project. David Kroyanker, an architect who has written more than 100 books and articles on Jerusalem, says Holy Land is the only physical monument to corruption he could think of in Israel. The most offensive thing about the project, he told me, is the bridges that connect the lower towers, making for a Lego-like fortress on a hilltop. The late star architect Ram Karmi was one of the early designers of Holy Land, and he left the project before it was built. In 2010, he told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that the developers of Holy Land, quote, murdered my concept and the buildings I planned. For now, the project is in a sort of limbo. This is the water fountain in the lobby of Sarnat's building. You can barely hear the water because of the loud buzzing of the elevators. In fact, most of the public areas are a mix of sparkling refinement and surprising neglect. The site was supposed to have 12 buildings, only 8 got built, and the pit for building number 9 has been open for the last 4 years. Sarnat opens his blinds to show me the sand that pit throws onto his balcony.
Look, see? We are in a construction site, and we have lots of dust, And when it rains, the piers of those unbuilt buildings fill with water. It's like pools.
To prevent people, especially kids, from falling into the pit, it's surrounded by aluminum siding that clatters in the wind. Despite these shortcomings, of the 642 apartments built, all but four were sold. The sales office, no longer useful, is still on site, its roof covered with garbage. Cats prowl around the back. And if you want to visit a friend in the project, prepare to hike. There's only enough parking for the residents. Visitors have to park down the hill and walk. The Jerusalem municipality has sued Holy Land's developers for tax fraud. The lots of the unbuilt towers are supposed to become public buildings, like schools or parks. Nothing has come to fruition yet. Danny and Devorah plan to move soon.
I have nothing against Holy Land, but I don't think we'll find anything appropriate here. I mean, we want to live somewhere on the top floor, and the top floors here, all our duplexes. We don't want to climb stairs anymore.
And while the Holy Land towers have been condemned as an eyesore, a monster, or even a set of rotting teeth, not all Jerusalemites are as disgusted.
It's a place nice.
Shmuel Chavilio, a local taxi driver, says, these buildings are nice, with a good view of all of Jerusalem. We should be like Tel Aviv with high rises, even on a hill, he says. Olmert has yet to start his jail term. He's still appealing his 6-year sentence. The buildings will almost certainly be there long after he gets out. For Monocle in Jerusalem, I'm Daniela Cheslow.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Thank you for listening. And remember that you can find out more about all of our shows at monocle.com and also on our free Monocle 24 app, ideal for listening on the road. And make sure you join us next week as we reminisce on 1960s utopias. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Michon, and it was edited by Holly Fisher and Alex Funnell. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Sleater-Kinney with No Cities to Love. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.